There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Coming up, we're going to find out what impact Brexit might have on Irish food exports, a new hack-proof mobile phone, and we'll also be asking what is your most financially frivolous indulgence. Now we look at the world of Islamic finance and the impact of a no-deal Brexit for the Islamic financial industry with Mohammed Damak, the global head of Islamic finance at S&P Global Ratings.
I think the impact would be significant on the five Islamic banks operating in the UK. Our economists project a drop in the GDP of the UK by around 2.9%, an increase in unemployment to 7.3%, and a cumulative drop in real estate price by about 9.5%. Now, if you look at the structure of the balance sheet of the Islamic banks in the UK, around 70% of their business is real estate financing.
70% is real estate financing?
Absolutely. So the impact would be significant. The impact would be on the asset quality of the banks. And we started to see some deterioration in asset quality. The impact would also be on the profitability of the Islamic banks operating in the UK. And if you look at the profitability, by the way, it's not that great. Return on asset is around 0.5%, and that's because of the low efficiency of these banks. Now, the positive thing is that if you look at the funding profile of the Islamic banks in the UK, it's mostly dominated by deposits, which means that even if there is a disruption in the wholesale funding market, this would not have an impact on them.
Okay, fine. That's the Islamic banks in the United Kingdom, the impact on Brexit. Let me ask you a similar question about the Islamic banks here, because you say that the massive exposure to real estate, we know Sharia-compliant financiers love asset-backed finance, they love real estate. Here in the UAE, we've had real estate prices come down by anywhere between 10 and 20, 25% over the past 3 or 4 years. What impact has that had on the Islamic banks here, the likes of Dubai Islamic Bank, Adib, and others?
I think the impact was negative on the asset quality indicators of these Islamic banks. And by the way, it's the same even for conventional banks. Real estate is an important component of the business of the banks in this region.
But to take a step back, you say that for British Islamic banks, real estate is 70% of what they do. What would that figure be for the local
It's
guys?
Much lower.
It's much lower.
It's
okay.
Much lower. It's much lower. It's around 20-ish percent of total loans.
When we started doing the Business Breakfast about sort of 14 years ago or so, we were talking about sukuks almost every other day, really, with a lot of issues. And we knew at that stage that Malaysia was driving the industry forward. Most of the sort of regulatory authorities seemed to be in Bahrain. And so we thought of Malaysia leading the market, Bahrain second. It was a very small business here in the UAE. What's the picture nowadays? Is Malaysia still driving the Islamic industry forward?
Malaysia is still. Malaysia and Indonesia together account for more than 50% of the sukuk that were issued last year. But this part of the world has started to play a bigger role. I think we saw in 2017, for example, a significant increase in sukuk issuance in the GCC, driven primarily by Saudi Arabia. And last year, in 2018, what saved the market in terms of issuance of sukuk was the Central Bank of Kuwait, which started to issue sukuk as liquidity management instrument for its Islamic banks, and also private sector issuers for in the UAE, where we saw a significant increase in the volume of issuance.
Am I right to though think of Bahrain as still as a sort of the capital of Islamic finance in the Gulf, despite Dubai's best efforts, simply because they've got an Islamic rating agency, they've got various other Islamic bodies?
They got also the AOIF, which is the Accounting and Auditing Organization for Islamic Financial Institution. But here in Dubai, we have the Dubai Islamic, Islamic Economy Development Center, which has been driving the Islamic finance agenda of Dubai, and now the authorities in the UAE are trying to develop a local currency sukuk market, which I think would be a game changer for the sukuk market if it were to be developed effectively.
So where would you say is now the Islamic finance capital of the Middle East?
I think it would be somewhere in the GCC.
Yeah, Alain, definitely.
Diplomatic.
Dibbers, pretty much Alain claimant. Let's talk about some of the other issues. Let's talk about retail Islamic finance. And again, looking back 10 years ago on the Business Breakfast, we would be talking, and we were talking, about how the big international banks were really investing heavily in Sharia-compliant finance. They saw a market of 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide, and they wanted to target that market. And one of the leaders at the time was HSBC with their Amana product. But then, a few years ago, they dialed back that HSBC retail Amana Sharia-compliant finance business here in the Middle East. Where do we stand now on a retail level, Mohammed?
On a retail level, I think there was a drop in the growth of the retail business, retail and corporate business, by the way, for the Islamic banks and the GCC. And globally, I think a few years ago, we were talking about a double-digit growth of the industry. Now, the growth is more mid-single digit, and that's because the industry is concentrated in countries that happen to be oil exporters. And with the drop in oil price from the triple digit to now, our base case scenario for 2019 is an average of 55, and the ensuing drop of the economic growth, there were lower opportunities to grow in the retail space.
I suppose to get real liquidity, there needs to be a crossover, non-Muslims investing in Islamic finance. Has that started to happen yet?
We saw some issuance of sukuk from non-Muslim jurisdictions. We saw the UK tapping the sukuk market, but it still remains embryonic. And one of the reasons why we are not seeing a lot more issuers tapping the market more aggressively, it's because of the complexity related to sukuk issuance. Now, if you look at the process of sukuk issuance compared to the process of issuing a conventional bond, it's much more complex, especially for people that are newcomers to Islamic finance. You need to adapt your local regulatory environment. You need to find an underlying asset. You need to find the best structure. You need to speak with lawyers, Sharia scholars, etc., and then eventually come to see us as a rating agency and then tap the market. And that process, if you're lucky or if you're a frequent issuer, could take you a few weeks. But if you are unlucky or if you are new to the industry, it could take you a few years. The UK announced its sukuk in 2008 and ended up tapping the market only in 2014.
Mohammed Damak is the global head of Islamic finance at S&P Global Ratings. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're with the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Now we look at how Brexit could impact Irish food exports with Eilish Ford, Director of Markets at Bord Beer. Bord Beer is the Irish food board. But first of all, we asked her, how much do Irish food exporters send to the UAE?
Last year, we sent 56 million euro worth of product, and to the region in general, to the Gulf region, 195 million. So it's a very important market for us. You're probably right in the sense of the impression of us as punching above our weight, because we are an exporting nation. So we produce a lot more food than we can consume because we have a small population. And so 90% of everything we produce, we export, and we export to 180 markets all
and
around the world.
You've got the important ingredients. You've got lots of nice grass, and you've got lots of nice rain as well to make that grass grow. But break that figure down, 56 million euros to the UAE. Mm-hmm. Break that down between meat and dairy, for instance.
Yeah, the most important products for us in the UAE are dairy and consumer foods. So 80% of what we export to the UAE is dairy. So that would be in terms of powders, in terms of butter, in terms of cheese.
Wow, and as much as that. Because I was thinking, I think Irish beef and I think, you know, wonderful product. And that's not a huge proportion.
No, we exported 4 million worth of meat to the UAE last year. It's very premium for us here in this market. It's very much a food service top restaurant business. But it's dairy is the main product that we export. The consumer foods are also very interesting in this market. And, you know, I was doing some store visits yesterday and you could really see it in Spinney's, for example. You know, lots of Irish product. And
things like Keogh's crisps and things like
Keogh's
that.
Yes, Keogh's crisps, exactly. Butler's chocolates, Kerrygold butter and cheese. So, yeah, no, it's great to see.
I was going to ask you where the UAE ranks in the Gulf in importance as an export market, but you were saying 56 to the UAE million euros and 195 to the Gulf. So it's roughly a quarter there.
Yes.
But how does the the UAE, with a relatively small population, stack up in terms of importance globally for Ireland, for you in the food board?
It's very important. And about 3 years ago, we really started to focus on market diversification. We were always very conscious of it, but we, you know, we had a particular focus on it. So what we did was we looked in terms of our important sectors, so meat, dairy, consumer foods, seafood, and looked to see in a very analytical way what were the more interesting unexplored markets. And the UAE came out very strongly in that. And as I said, the products were particularly dairy and consumer foods.
Now, one of my summer holiday plans this year is to go to the English market in Cork to have a look at all the wonderful Irish foodstuffs on display there. But I suppose we ought to talk about the B word, the Brexit word, because it's confusing the heck out of just about everybody at the moment, including politicians themselves. And I think it's probably no exaggeration, not just in the UK, but also in Ireland as well. I can only imagine really how much up in the air you are as an exporter on the front line and how you feel at the moment, because there's no clear solution emerging and the days are ticking away. What official line is Bord Beer taking?
Well, our official line really is that we are doing everything we can to prepare for a Brexit that is going to be workable for us. So, you know, what we're saying to our companies as well, our client companies, is that we really need to hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And so what we've been doing with companies is 2 years ago, we did an analysis with companies. We took a sample survey of exporting food companies to see where were they struggling. And the main thing that people struggle with is exactly what you said. It's the uncertainty. So they don't know. When companies know what to face, that makes it much easier for them.
What percentage of all Irish food exports go to the UK at the moment?
Just over 25%.
25%. So, yeah. And what percentage of those go across the border into Northern Ireland and that route into the UK?
I can't give you an exact percentage, but we certainly do have some of that. So with milk, for example, we're going, you know, we can be crossing over and back
and that's
on the
where
border.
The risk might be at that border,
well,
hard border, potentially.
It's the logistics of that I think are going to be challenging.
Looking on your Bord Beer website, and it carries a Bord Beer Brexit barometer.
Yes.
What's that
yes.
showing at the moment?
That's the barometer that I was talking about. That's the analysis. So what we find is that companies where they really need assistance are with things like customs, things like logistics, like supply chain. What we do find and what's very interesting is since we first did it 2 years ago, we are seeing a progression. So we've been running workshops for companies on exactly those things that they were finding challenging. So in terms of currency, in terms of customs. And so that is really improving. And the other major thing that we discovered was that companies really needed to up their game in terms of marketing strategies, official marketing strategies, not just for the UK, but for all around the world. And we've been giving support to companies in terms of doing that.
How do you fare as a market in terms of size? We had the Welsh Food Board on the programme a couple of days ago, because obviously the big food show is on here at the moment. And they were saying, look, because of the size of Wales, they can't really compete with the bigger markets such as Australia and New Zealand, where you've got economies of scale. Mm. Does that also apply to Ireland? Do you have that sort of same restriction simply because of the size of the country?
No, we don't feel that because we feel that we've an awful lot to offer. And part of what we have to offer is that I think our image as this island nation on the Western seaboard, that consumers really resonate with that in terms of the naturalness of the product, in terms of the grass-fed that you mentioned with our animals out in the fields. And so that whole sustainability piece. And we have a national sustainability programme. It's the only country in the world that has a national programme. So all of the industries working together, from farmers to the processors to the retailers and food service operators, in terms of setting stretch targets on sustainability, and that could be in terms of waste or carbon or community sustainability. And then we track that. And I think that really does resonate with people, with our customers all around the world. So that's where we see we make a difference.
Talk us through your Origin Green programme, please, and what other countries might be able to learn from it. And I'm guessing it's a sort of an Irish first sort of promotion.
Yeah, it's the sustainability programme that I'm mentioning there. So it's very much about an integrated approach in the industry towards sustainability. Because we did quite a lot of research in the last couple of years with both customers and consumers to really understand what sustainability means to those people and what they're looking for. And what we found is that people are really looking for a product that's safe, that's natural, and that where they can see that people are really making an effort in terms of sustainability. And the other very important thing about our Origin Green programme is that it's aligned to the United Nations sustainability goals. So it's those same goals. There's a lot of commonality in terms of trying to really do everything we can to be as sustainable as we can be.
Well, Eilish, thanks so much for coming in to join us and letting you go, I should say. Eilish Ford, Director of Markets at the Irish Food Board, Bord Beer. Goodbye in Gaelic. But unfortunately, I spent so long learning to say Giagwich, hello, that I didn't get round to learning how to say goodbye. What should I be saying?
Slán, much easier.
As like Sláinte, is it?
Exactly, a bit like Sláinte, yeah, same pronunciation, Slán.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Gair maith agat, thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi there, you're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Cyber crime fighters Dark Matter join us now as they prepare to showcase a hack-proof handset at the world's top mobile phone event in Barcelona, the World Mobile Congress. Ravi Debussy is SVP for Sales, Marketing and Business Development at Dark Matter, and he explained to us what the CATIM R01 actually does.
This device is a second generation CATIM device. 2 years ago, I was here in the studio and we talked to you about CATIM, the first generation of our ultra secure mobile. The CATIM R1 is designed, purpose-built to withstand the harshest and most extreme field conditions, in addition to making it tougher on the inside with technologies that would secure your data, secure your communications, secure your chat, voice, and video, and ultimately giving you a peace of mind that your decisions and your data that you share on your mobile are secure.
So it's, as well as the cybersecurity, it's also physically tough.
It is physically tough on the desk, on the outside. We drop on the desk. We have basically a drop resilience. We have shock resilience. We have water and dust resilience. It's got a lot of features. The screen is hardened. You can operate it. Actually, I'm a diver, so I struggle a lot with my commercial phones where my hands are gloved and wet.
40 feet down trying to make a phone call.
Well, when I come up, so I have an issue with wearing a glove, especially if it's wet, I can't operate my phone. So this phone is designed to be to have glove touch and wet hands operation. In addition to this, it withstands extreme temperature conditions and harsh conditions when it comes to shock and drop and vibration.
Is it bulletproof?
Well, I mean, no, it's not bulletproof.
You haven't tried it.
We haven't tried it. We don't have a gun, so we can't try it. But the reason behind this is the phone is designed, the CATIM range of mobiles is designed for decision makers, government leaders, industry leaders that are making the hardest decisions, the most sensitive, and they deal with classified and important information for the entity they represent. So those organizations require the highest level of security for the data. And what's happened over the last couple of years is we've become more dependent on our mobile devices. We actually do almost everything from our mobile device, whether you're an individual or a government leader or a decision maker in a company. And for some of those individuals, they require the operation of their mobile device in harsh and extreme conditions, whether it's temperature, wet, potential of drop, pressure. I've broken a personal phone while sitting on it in the past. So there you go. It's designed to withstand the harsh conditions and to still afford you the ultimate security for your data.
I'm guessing that the weaknesses in phones is how the signal is carried from the phone to wherever you're sending a message or a bit of data. And we know that Huawei's been in the spotlight for its involvement with 5G networks, etc., and the risk of security there. Founder of Huawei overnight saying there's no way the US can crush the company. They need us. How are you going to get information from A to B from that phone?
That's a very good question, Malcolm. The technology that we use in this phone is based on our years of design of encrypting the bearer channels, which is the communication channel between two devices. So we secure the chat messages, we secure the voice communication, we secure the video communication. But we also secure the data that sits on the phone itself. So we encrypt and protect that data. There's additional technologies and innovations here, such as tamper-proofing. So if somebody tries to pry the phone open or remove the screen or drill a hole in the phone, there are sensors in the phone that will wipe the phone. The phone will wipe itself clean and it'll deem itself unworkable.
Finally, Expo 2020 Dubai is little more than a year away now, 18 months away. You're the official cybersecurity partner for them. What can you tell us about what you're working on? What's keeping the guys at Expo awake at night when it comes to cybersecurity? And very briefly, what are you doing to try and remove that problem?
So look, the event is going to be a very innovative event. There's a big reliance on technology. And we all know when you use technology, there is a big threat. The attack surface becomes wider. And we're helping them protect their digital footprint, digital infrastructure, and ultimately deliver a secure and successful event.
Rabbi Debussy, Senior Vice President at Dark Matter. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
We're asking you, what are the frivolous financial indulgences that drain your money? Here's the thing. This is all sparked by Kevin O'Leary, who's an American multimillionaire. He stars on the program Shark Tank, where he invests in entrepreneurial startup companies. And he's written a piece on CNBC outlining the three stupid things that millennials waste money on. He makes the point that people aged 25 to 36 in the United States have, on average, $42,000 worth of debt. And most of it isn't student loans from playing.
$42,000.
And it's not student loans, it's credit card debt.
Isn't it?
It is a lot of money. That's an average, obviously. Some will be significantly higher than that. And he says part of it is wasting money on things that you just don't need. Number one is $4 coffee. He describes that as incredibly stupid. He says, look, I know I'm going to get a lot of hate mail from the coffee brands, but coffee costs 18 cents to make yourself. Until you've got savings and have paid off your college debt, do not buy a $4 coffee. He says, I forbid you. The second thing is shoes. And do you remember how many pairs of shoes he says we should have in our closet?
Four.
Four pairs of shoes only. You need flip-flops. You need something to work out in and two pairs of dress shoes. He says everything else, you're an idiot if you're buying more shoes than that because you will never, ever wear them. He does say, though, that women are worse offenders than men.
That's not a surprise.
Perhaps not, but the evidence backs it up. It's not just intuition. Shoe retailer DSW found last year that on average American women have 20 pairs of shoes while the average man has just 12 pairs of shoes.
20 pairs of shoes?
For women.
That's on average, yeah.
And men have about 12 pairs of shoes.
I suppose the upside is there'll be people with hundreds, really, isn't there? There'll be people with just, what, half a dozen, I suppose.
There will be people following Kevin O'Leary's advice, but many don't.
Wow.
And the related thing, the third thing, stupid thing, to use his phrase, that millennials waste their money on, is jeans. The number of pairs of jeans you should have in your closet, Malcolm, do you remember this one?
I don't. I think the answer should be one, but it's probably more than that.
It is three, he says. No more than three pairs of jeans. Any more than that, and you are wasting money. This is Kevin O'Leary explaining to CNBC your clothing strategy.
I mean, it's amazing. All the shoes, all the pants, all the shirts that I never wore after the first time I bought them. What a waste of money. I could have had that money making 7 or 8% a year in perpetuity, but I didn't. I bought all that. So if you're 20, listen to what Mr. Wonderful's saying here. You need three baseball caps. You need six t-shirts. You need three pairs of jeans, white, traditional blue, and black. And when they wear out, buy another one. I look at how I travel today. I have a suitcase with basically two suits, two jeans, a whole bunch of underwear that costs $150 a pair. That's a little splurging, but you don't have to do that. Five pairs of socks, a pair of pajamas, that's it. It turns out that's all I need. And I go home and I've got racks and racks of stuff I don't wear.
Now he, Kevin O'Leary, has a net worth of $400 million, so he can afford to blow $150 on underwear, but most people cannot, and we should be more frugal. Thanks so much. So many messages coming in from you guys about your financial indulgences. It seems to me that coffee is up there, as Kevin O'Leary suggested. Also, cars and golf, they are up there. Maram admits that she has a very expensive hobby.
I spend it on cosplay. I mean, I make my own costumes, but the material cost kind of piles up.
I'd say that's right. If you're making your own costumes, that's a creative pursuit rather than simply buying stuff and sticking it in a cupboard somewhere.
I think you'd have to throw phones in here as well. People love having multiple phones. People buy the latest phones as well. Maybe that's an overindulgence.
Mike says his indulgence is not only expensive, but he's not very good at it.
Yeah, that's my overview of how much indulgence I have for golf. The pleasure overweighs the frustration.
I know, I'm not playing much golf at the moment, but when I was, boy, if I just buy this one club, this new putter, that's going to try. We all fall for it.
Why don't you? You're a hole-in-one guy. I mean, it did work.
I guess it did, didn't it? Abdi has been in touch. Abdi says not indulging in his expensive habit could have saved him some money to buy something else.
I bought, for example, a nice BMW. And I only find sometime I had a Porsche. But then I realized that when I wanted to check the value of the car, I realized that I'd lost so much that I could have actually bought two Rolexes with it. And the funny thing is, I don't have a Rolex.
These are high-class problems that Abdi's facing,
aren't
they?
That's one of my regrets, actually, I guess.
Maybe you could have used the money towards your savings or investments, college fund for your kids. But Abdi, joking apart, thanks very much indeed for getting in touch.
I mean, it's the old joke, wasn't it? How do you become a millionaire? Start as a billionaire and invest in .com. from 20 years ago, that one. But it's the same idea, isn't it? Cars, I mean, unless you are lucky enough to strike that sort of one in a million car that is an appreciator, you are going to lose money. And it goes one way.
Kaushik is fountain pens.
That's interesting.
That's an interesting one.
But they could also be a really good collector's item, you know, if you buy those rarest pens.
I would tend to agree.
Like watches, really.
Heinrich is fishing. Fair enough, but again, if you're investing in an experience, I'm not sure that's really wasting money. It's buying stuff that you don't need and just stick it in a cupboard and forgetting about it. That's wasting money.
I think you're right. I mean, that's a life experience, isn't it, fishing?
Yeah, if you're spending your Friday afternoons on a boat in the sea fishing for barracuda, then I think that's...
I see where you're going with this. You're starting to make the excuse for going out and playing golf. It's a life experience, darling.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai i 103.8.
Thank you for listening. We are back tomorrow, 6 a.m. on The Business Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at dubaii1038.com.